From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. William Styron is the author of The Confessions of Nat Turner and Sophie's Choice. In 1985, he was overcome by a depression he described as the gray drizzle of horror. That depression is the subject of Styron's new memoir and of our interview on today's Fresh Air. Classic Gothic fiction uses gloomy and gruesome settings to frighten the reader. Coming up, we meet writer Patrick McGraw. His new Gothic fiction is about psychological torment. And eating for fitness may be the latest rage, but commentator John Jefferson tells us why deep-fried food is still right as rain to Southerners. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The House of Representatives today approved a $283 billion defense bill despite threats of a presidential veto. The measure would cut almost $2.5 billion from Star Wars and stop production of the B-2 bomber. NPR's Cokie Roberts reports.
Despite pleas from the leading Republican on the House Armed Services Committee to kill the defense bill, the measure passed by a vote of 256 to 155. Though many members of the House would like to reduce military money as much as possible, most knew that the amount of this bill would not be the defense sum that eventually reaches the president's desk. That number will be determined by the as-yet-unresolved budget summit and will be agreed upon by both political parties in Congress and the Bush administration. But without a budget summit completed, the House was bound by the amount for defense approved early this year by its budget committee, long before the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. That invasion changed the calculation for defense, and that changed world situation will be reflected in the final bill, which emerges from a House-Senate conference committee. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The State Department said today that it's planning just one more charter flight to evacuate Americans from Iraq and Kuwait. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler said it's believed that the flight, planned for Saturday, will accommodate all the Americans Iraq is permitting to leave. She urged all Americans who wish to leave and who were permitted to leave to be on the final plane. Tutwiler says that 1,700 Americans have been evacuated from Iraq on charters. Thousands of foreign men, including several hundred Americans, have been prevented from leaving. United Nations officials say the refugee crisis in the Gulf has eased. They're now preparing for any new exodus from Iraq and Kuwait. The BBC's Christopher Powell reports from Geneva.
While not mentioning the possibility of war in the Gulf, it's clear that the United Nations officials want to be prepared for any eventuality. The coordinator of the disaster relief organization, Mohamed Essefi, told government officials that the refugee situation had improved. The number in Jordan had dropped from 41,000 people at the end of last week to just over 33,000 yesterday. Enough food had been donated, he said, to feed 40,000 refugees for 3 months. But these figures are tiny compared to the prospect of 2 million people fleeing the outbreak of fighting in the Gulf. UNDRO says it's important that governments do not withdraw the offers of help which they've made already simply because the present stream of refugees seems to be slowing.
Christopher Powell in Geneva. Stock prices fell today on Wall Street after Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan gave no sign that the central bank might be willing to ease interest rates. The Dow Industrials lost 14 points to close at 2,557.43. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Novelist William Styron recently experienced the kind of suicidal depression he had written about in his fiction. His first novel, Lie Down in Darkness, was about madness and alcoholism in a southern middle-class family. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1968 for his historical novel, The Confessions of Nat Turner, about the leader of a slave rebellion. Sophie's Choice, which is about the psychological after effects of surviving the Holocaust, won a 1980 American Book Award and was adapted into a film starring Meryl Streep. In 1985, Styron was overcome by a depression so unrelenting he nearly took his life. After months of pain and disorientation, he checked into a hospital. 7 weeks later, the fog began to lift. Styron has written about this in his new book, Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. Our interview begins with a reading from his book.
In virtually any other serious sickness, a patient who felt similar devastation would be lying flat in bed, possibly sedated and hooked up to the tubes and wires of life support systems, but at the very least in a posture of repose and in an isolated setting. His invalidism would be necessary, unquestioned, and honorably attained. However, the sufferer from depression has no such option, and therefore finds himself like a walking casualty of war, thrust into the most intolerable social and family situations. There he must, despite the anguish devouring his brain, present a face approximating the one that is associated with ordinary events and companionship. He must try to utter small talk and be responsive to questions and knowingly nod and frown and, God help him, even smile. But it is a fierce trial attempting to speak a few simple words.
I think a lot of people are empiricists when it comes to disease. If you don't have a fever or if there isn't a limb falling off,
right,
you go about your business.
Right.
You don't like using the word depression. You don't think it really gets across how this state of mind really feels.
Yeah, I wish there were another word, but there isn't. So I do use it, but sort of with a sense that it's inadequate, really.
Can we talk about what that state of mind feels like, what your symptoms were?
Well, the thing I've tried to insist in a mild way throughout whenever I've written about the illness is that it's virtually indescribable. It doesn't resemble it's pain, but it's pain that is, as William James said, that is totally unknown to normal experience. It's a pain that normal people have never felt, that is, people who live in a normal frame of health, a frame of mind. I think the closest I've ever been able to hit upon an analogous pain is that of suffocation, or of being imprisoned in an intensely hot room from which there's no escape. It's that kind of sort of diabolical discomfort that it resembles more than anything.
You went through a long period of dreamless sleep. When did you start realizing that you weren't dreaming anymore?
Well, very early on in the course of the depression, I realized that something odd had happened, that along with the intense insomnia that accompanies this illness, there was indeed a dreamlessness, an absence of what I guess the experts would call an REM sleep, which is that rapid eye movement sleep that attends dreaming. And I didn't have any. It disappeared.
You write that exhaustion combined with sleeplessness is a rare torture. What would you do when you were lying awake at night, knowing that it was very unlikely that you'd ever really fall asleep?
Well, that's when you really begin to brood in the most profound way upon the meaninglessness of this illness, which really becomes a kind of point of departure for thinking about maybe a life is not really worth living. If this kind of torture, if indeed daily experience becomes a form of torture, and if in addition to that the torture appears to be something that's going to have no termination, then what point is a life? That's when people begin, I think, in this very common moment of experience to think about suicide.
Let me ask you, this may sound like a really dumb question, but how different was this period of depression from ordinary life for you? I mean, were you like very moody and often depressed before this illness set in?
No, you know, I think that's one of the interesting things. I'd always prided myself, and I'll always have, being somewhat of a amateur expert in medical matters. A depression and its manifestations were something totally alien to me. I don't know but whether I might have consciously or subconsciously repressed the very idea of learning anything about depression. At any rate, until this thing happened to me, I was an ignoramus about a depressive illness. And therefore, although I may remember retrospectively moods of low moods, I never once before this thing happened to me, as far as I can tell, ever had a serious depressive episode. It was an alien experience to me.
Writer William Styron is my guest. Were you able to write during your depression?
No. During a serious depression, the intellectual faculties are really exterminated. They don't exist. The power of concentration. One ultimately is I found that I was unable really to read a newspaper or even look at television, even look at a news program. At that moment, ultimately, not only is the concentration erased, the power of concentration, but the pain that is coexisting with the rest of one's bodily functions is so intense that it's a matter of total distractedness. You can't really concentrate on anything. It's akin to having an overwhelming pain which completely dominates one's mind and one's experience.
What do you think brought on this depression?
Well, in my own case, as I said in the book, I for the first time in my life, I was unable to drink. I suffered an intolerance to alcohol very, very suddenly, in a matter of days. It was as if something had occurred in my metabolism to cause alcohol to cause me to be nauseated and repulsed by alcohol. And so I had to stop drinking. It was as simple as that. And I think the withdrawal from alcohol, the sudden withdrawal of a substance I had been abusing for so many years, allowed the anxieties which that very alcohol had stifled to come down upon me and to take possession of me.
You were also taking tranquilizers to sleep at night, and you think that might have contributed too?
Definitely. I had taken for, as a result of a foolish doctor whom I'd asked to help me over a rather temporary bout of insomnia. I'd asked this doctor to give me a prescription for something. He gave me something called Ativan. And Ativan is a minor tranquilizer, which is also, if you take it long enough, quite addictive. And as a matter of fact, I shouldn't have been taking it for more than a couple of weeks, and I had taken it for 2 years. I think one of the reasons that this depression was exaggerated was the moment when I went off Ativan without any realization that to do so was really a very dangerous thing, which potentiated the depression.
Then you ended up taking something else.
And then I began to take Halcyon, which is another doctor prescribed. And Halcyon at that time was, although it was not known then to be a dangerous pill, has been demonstrated to be extremely dangerous in that certain susceptible individuals, such as myself, can really get all the suicidal symptoms that depression itself offers. And I had that. It was toward the end of this depression, or toward the, I should say, the weeks before I went into the hospital, I was taking a much more hefty dose of Halcyon than I should have, and I'm convinced that exaggerated the symptoms.
Your parents were depressive too, weren't they?
Well, my father was. My mother, I don't think, was. My father definitely had suffered from this illness in a very serious way, I have no doubt that was a contributory factor, certainly.
William Styron is my guest. He won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Confessions of Nat Turner and the American Book Award for Sophie's Choice. His new memoir is about his depression and his getting over it. It's called Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. Looking back at your previous books, do you think that there's a sense of your depression, which came later, reflected in your earlier books?
Oh, absolutely. As I said in the book, my book, Darkness Visible, after I recovered from this depression, I was amazed to see how accurately I had, out of my own probable subconscious, created the mood of depression fictionally in the minds of these various characters that I had created, Peyton Loftus and Sophie and her lover Nathan, who were all depressive people, all suicidal. All of this came from somewhere, and I suspect they came out of my subconscious.
As it turns out, you had several friends who were also depressives, some of whom were actually suicidal. Did it help or hurt to talk to those friends, especially if they were in a similar depressed state?
Well, I think it's invaluable to talk to people who are your fellow sufferers or who have experienced this illness. I think it can't be emphasized enough that people who get well and recover from this illness often do so through the moral support of others, people who keep telling them that they're going to get well, because most people do indeed get well. But it requires a great deal of patience and a great deal of fellowship on the part of others to help one through.
Did hearing that you were going to get well, did hearing that from fellow sufferers have a lot more meaning than hearing it from people who were, you know, high-spirited and would tell you, hey, things will be fine, just hang in there?
Yes. The best example is my friend Art Buchwald, the columnist, who is one of my closest friends. And he had gone through this illness very seriously just a few months before I had. And when he was coming out of his, I was going in mine. And it was his support. He was on the phone to me from Washington to Connecticut virtually every day for weeks. I was reporting in. He would say, how are you doing? One day I'd say, a little bit better, I think, or the next day I'm down. And he was always there with these words of support and saying, look, you're going to get well, and you should, don't give up. If you have to go to the hospital, go. And this was very important to me.
Can you describe the point at which you realized that you were getting suicidal?
Well, it was a long, progressive situation. Once this illness takes hold in its extreme, as I said before, when the pain becomes so constant and enduring, you say, well, is life worth living? And then I don't think you can, at least I can't describe the exact moment when I said I could take my life, but I do recall that the sense of the futility and hopelessness and the pain was all so great that not a day went by when I did not actively contemplate ways to end my life.
There was one time, as you describe in your memoir, when you came really close to suicide, but you found you couldn't possibly draft a suicide note. Did you have this literary self-consciousness about it? Like, well, what if they printed it in the newspaper? I'd have to really use like all the right words here and make it worthy of my career as a writer.
Well, I think that was, to be quite honest, that may have been a component of my inability to finally get it down. But basically, it was The total futility of trying to adequately express anything about this prodigious act that one is contemplating. You begin to say to think to yourself, well, I want to say farewell to so and so, and then it's like a guest list at a party. You don't know. You're wondering who you left out. So it all becomes a kind of a semi-comical activity. And ultimately, at least in my case, quite impossible. I just gave up the attempt.
Well, it sounds like you were almost treating it like the acknowledgments page of a book.
Precisely.
You thank your editor.
Yes, that's right.
Your wife for her patience.
Yeah. And, you know, in the end, you feel you're omitting someone, and you just... And also, it is, after all, it's a terminal act, and you don't know exactly what you want to say. So you end up, as I did, tearing up the notes and resolving to say nothing.
You remember what you wrote in those notes that you tore up?
I remember very little, except I recalled that I did say to myself that I put down that my work was beginning to suffer from a psychotic strain, which I felt was attached to the psychotic strain in my mind. And I expressed similar ideas of futility. And they were real, but they looked so ugly on the page that I just decided that I would tear them up.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is William Styron, and he's written a new memoir, which is called Darkness Visible. This is Fresh Air. William Styron is my guest, and he's the author of The Confessions of Nat Turner and Sophie's Choice. He has a new memoir about his period of depression, and it's called Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. Things eventually got so bad, you decided to just check yourself into a hospital. What did you expect to get from a hospital that you couldn't get at home?
Well, I think what one finally seeks for in the hospital is safety, seclusion. After all, in a house, and let's be blunt about it, you're able to at least find the means to destroy yourself. And this, ultimately, in major depression, is a total preoccupation. In a hospital, this is no longer possible, except in you know, sort of bizarre instances. Good hospitals are so constituted that, among other things, suicide is made an impossibility. That's the major reason. And indeed, when I was in the hospital, I found that the sense of security was so great, ultimately, that I lost these suicidal ideas. They disappeared.
You had to attend group therapy sessions while you were hospitalized, and you said that they left you seething. Why did you hate group therapy?
Well, I would never, as I insisted in the book, disclaim group therapy as a mode of assistance for other people, because plainly group therapy seems to work for some people. For me, I suppose I'm an individualist, and reject the idea of groups, and it didn't work for me. I didn't particularly like the psychiatrist who was the supervising this group therapy. I found him arrogant and vain. So these things were factors that nullified group therapy for me, but I would not want to cancel it out for other people.
To what do you attribute your recovery?
I think important to the recovery was among other things, but I want to be blunt about this too. I consider the withdrawal from Halcyon, or the cessation of Halcyon, as being an important factor. But I would not attribute my depression entirely to this pill at all. I was headed for a downward slide without Halcyon. I do think that ultimately my recovery was because in the hospital I found a kind of seclusion, a kind of ability to feel safe, and a sequestration, a place where I really withdrawn from the chaos of normal life, I found peace.
How does it feel to you now to be talking about your illness? You were hospitalized, I think, in 1985.
Right.
So that's 5 years ago. Do you feel like, well, it's safe to talk about it now? This is all way in the past. Or do you still feel vulnerable to this state of mind again?
I don't think that in the normal sequence of events that I'm going to get another seizure of this illness. I may be whistling in the dark, But I'm quite aware that depression does recur in many, many cases. I feel if it does come back on me, I will be armed in a certain way to psychologically fend it off, its worst incursions anyway, because I've been there and I think I know how to deal with some of it more readily.
Is this memoir the first thing you've written since your sickness?
No, I've been writing a novel for several years, and this is the first. I've written quite a few essays, published here and there, and a long novella. And as I say, I'm deep in progress in a novel. So I feel quite creative in the best sense of the word.
How do you think being depressed and then getting through it has affected your writing?
Certainly, it has not affected it negatively. I'm not sure whether the experience of depression leaves you a better person. I very much doubt it. I think you're very much the same person you were. But you have been there. You've experienced something that of dreadful compass, you could say, something that you've been in a strange country, and to come back from that country and to be able to reflect on it and write about it is in itself a rather chastening and also an enlightening experience, self-enlightening, because it's a place you never expected to be, and it's a horrible place, and to come back and be able to deal with it is very cathartic.
Earlier you were talking about when you looked back on your novels, you realized that a lot of the characters you'd created had been depressives,
mm-hmm.
and had been suicidal. So how is this depressive state of mind showing up in the fiction that you're writing now?
Not really at all. I've purged that aspect out of my writing life. Maybe it's no longer of any importance to me. Having confronted my own disease, maybe I don't seem to have the necessity to impose it upon any of my fictional characters. That doesn't bother me in the slightest. I'm writing about something else in which depression need not be a feature, and so I feel free of the need to deal with it any much longer.
William Styron, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
My guest has been William Styron. His new book is called Darkness Visible, A Memoir of Madness. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, poet Gary Snyder. He was part of the beat poetry scene in San Francisco in the late 50s, and he appears as a character in some of Jack Kerouac's books. Snyder has since won the Pulitzer Prize and continues to write and teach. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eviscerated corpses, amputated limbs, and moving walls used to be the images in Patrick McGraw's stories, but now he relies more on psychological torment to quicken the pulse of his readers. Coming up, Patrick McGraw talks about new Gothic fiction, and he reads from his new novel, Spider. And commentator John Jefferson sings the praises of good old-fashioned Southern cooking. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Bush administration today defended its plan to write off some $7 billion in military aid extended to Egypt. Bush administration officials assured members of Congress that the debt forgiveness was not setting a precedent for other countries. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger told lawmakers today Egypt deserves to have its loans forgiven. It has backed U.S. policy by sending troops to help defend Saudi Arabia, and its already faltering economy will be further strained by millions of Egyptians fleeing Iraq. Addressing a concern that the U.S. is providing aid to Arab states at the expense of Israel, Eagleburger said that the U.S. is formulating a new assistance package for Tel Aviv.
The administration accepts the principle that having done what's been done with regard to the Arab states, there needs to be balance in the way in which we deal with Israel.
Some lawmakers fear that nations will be lining up to have their debts to the U.S. written off, but Eagleburger insisted that Egypt is a special case and said forgiving its military debts was the right thing to do. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Iraq has announced it has impounded the assets of countries which have frozen its money and property overseas. However, Western bankers say that they have little of value in the country. Hundreds of foreign firms have contracts in Iraq to build such things as power plants, factories, roads, and bridges. Japan and Italy have projects between them amounting to almost $15 billion. In New York City, diplomatic sources say that the UN Security Council's five permanent members are very close to agreement on a resolution imposing an air blockade against Iraq. Linda Fasulu reports.
Over the past few days, the five permanent members of the Security Council have been fine-tuning the language of a resolution that tightens UN sanctions against Iraq. The resolution will extend the UN embargo against Baghdad to airplanes flying to and from Iraq and occupied Kuwait. Countries would be directed not to give overflight rights to planes unless the planes agree to have their cargo inspected. The measure also outlines circumstances under which nations should detain Iraqi ships and reminds the international community to freeze all Iraqi and Kuwaiti assets. Finally, the resolution warns that the Council will consider taking future action against sanction busters. The full Security Council is expected to vote on the measure Friday. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasula reporting.
Officials in Jordan say that country's economy could collapse by late next month unless there is a large amount of financial aid. The finance minister of Jordan says his country will lose more than $2 billion during a first year of a Persian Gulf crisis. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 14 points to close at 2,557.43. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. For those of us who are drawn to tales of madness, violence, and perversity, there's a substantial tradition of Gothic fiction. Poe, Kafka, and Mary Shelley all contributed to the imagery and drama of the Gothic form. My guest, Patrick McGraw, is a writer who's updating the genre. He's the author of a collection of short stories, Blood and Water and Other Tales, and a novel, The Grotesque. He's also editing an anthology of new Gothic fiction. McGraw has a new novel, Spider, and in a few minutes he'll read us an excerpt from it. I was struck when reading Spider by how McGraw's writing has changed, moving away from the bizarre and supernatural to the psychological.
I think that's very true. Spider is very much a portrait of a schizophrenic, and whatever elements of the macabre, the perverse, the grotesque that are contained within that book are very much a function of a psychotic mind breaking down rather than, in any sense, pieces of gratuitous horror for their own sake.
Why is your fiction moving in that direction?
I think because the Gothic genre that I've been fascinated and delighted with for a number of years now is beginning to show me just what it's capable of in terms of handling extreme psychological states. And I'm growing more interested in what it can do in terms of depiction of extreme psychological states than I am in simply, filling a story with as many sort of dark and nasty images as I can come up with.
Let me ask you for your comparison of Gothic versus New Gothic fiction.
Well, I think the traditional Gothic did lay a lot of stress on the furniture, on the dripping caves and the mouldering mansions on the top of hills and dark forests. There's a great stress on the props and the sets. We no longer need those props and sets in order to depict the sorts of characters that inhabited those sorts of locations, and now we can simply depict the mind itself, and it doesn't have to be accompanied by clanking chains and gloomy fortresses and so on. So I think the Gothic is now much more exclusively a psychological condition.
So your fiction is in a way kind of following the changes that have happened in the form.
Yeah, many of the stories in Blood and Water were very much pastiches of the form in which I played with certain standard Gothic elements like severed hands or vampires or bad priests and so on. And at that point, I was really just taking a delight in the Gothic and its excesses. And as I said, now I'm much more interested in the implications of working that sort of terrain, that sort of, you know, that dark side of normality and reason and order and so on. And that is giving me more and more insight into the ways of handling madness and perversity within fiction.
You joined us a couple of years ago on Fresh Air when your collection of short stories was published. Mm. And our listeners might remember that you grew up near the gate of an institution for the criminally insane in London, and your father was the medical superintendent there. How does that figure specifically into your new novel, Spider?
As a result of growing up the son of my father, I was equipped with a fairly thorough grounding in mental illness as a small boy. I later worked in his hospital and in another hospital in Canada, and so I got to know at first hand what schizophrenia looks like and other forms of mental illness. When I came to write fiction, I found that this formed a sort of a reservoir of knowledge that I more and more have been able to draw on, which has culminated in this latest novel, which is really centrally a depiction of schizophrenia from a first-hand account of schizophrenia.
I believe your father is retired, but did you show him the manuscript, and did he give you any advice?
Yeah, I would show him the manuscript in various early drafts, and he was very quick to tell me what was plausible and what was not in what I was depicting as, you know, as a schizophrenic condition. In fact, when I wanted to actually have a relatively a gentle ending to the novel, he told me that this, in fact, was not plausible, that the schizophrenic's fate is generally a rather grim one. So he did push me in the direction of you know, not shying away from the full sort of ghastly horror that schizophrenia is.
What are the considerations when you're writing a book and the narrator is mentally unbalanced, like in your book?
This was the great technical challenge here, was to contain the incoherence and the wildness of madness within the order and the continuity that the novel form demands. And I don't know if I can quite put my finger on how I solved that problem, but a lot of it has to do with, I think, using different time frames. And Spider is always in... he is referring back to his childhood, he's referring to the present, and he's also referring to his period in mental hospital. So there's three times that are occurring simultaneously within the novel, and I found that if I moved between these three times, I could, when Spider began to sort of drift off into the more wild areas of his illness, I could bring us back by moving to a different, you know, he would perhaps begin to talk about the present and what he was experiencing in the present as a way of reining us in and giving us once more the sense of where the narrative's going.
When a narrator is schizophrenic, like the character who narrates your novel, the reader really doesn't know how much to trust him.
No, not at all. So the reader has to almost read a second text beyond the one that's in front of him. You have to, in some way, second-guess Spider and understand by what principle he is constantly distorting what it is that he's reporting to you. And once you catch that principle, then you can begin to really interpret what he's telling. You say, no, I know this is not true, but I understand that when he says this, what he means is this, because I've begun to see, you know, the ways in which he contradicts himself and the sorts of anomalies there are in his account.
In just a few moments, you're going to read to us from your new novel, Spider. Is there anything you'd like to say to prepare us for the reading?
Just to remember that by the time you've got to that point in the book, you may well have begun to suspect that Spider's account of things may be somewhat flawed, and to perhaps be alert to that as you hear him describe himself and his father and his mother. Just be alert to the those points at which perhaps he protesteth too much.
Okay, Patrick, thanks very much. And stay with us, because Patrick McGraw is going to read from his new novel, Spider, after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Here's Patrick McGraw to introduce his reading from his new novel, Spider.
Our narrator in this passage is a strange, sad, solitary figure called Spider. Now, after an absence of 20 years, Spider returns to the slums of the East End of London, where he grew up, and moves into a seedy boarding house run by the indomitable Mrs. Wilkinson. In this passage, he'll recall memories of his father, Horace, a plumber, and of his long-suffering mother. I haven't even told you my name yet. It's Dennis, but my mother always called me Spider. I am a baggy, threadbare sort of a customer, really. My clothes have always seemed to flap about me like sailcloth, like sheets and shrouds. I catch a glimpse of them sometimes as I hobble through these empty streets, and they always look vacant, untenanted, the way the flannel flaps and hollows about me, as though I were nothing, and the clothes were clinging merely to an idea of a man, the man himself being elsewhere, naked. These feelings disappear when I reach my bench, for there I am anchored. I have a wall behind me and water in front of me, and as long as I don't look at the gasworks, all is well. But I had a bit of a shock yesterday, for I discovered that nothing fit me any more. I noticed it first when I got up from the bench. My trousers barely reached the tops of my ankles, and from the ends of my sleeves, my wrists were poking out to an absurd length, like sticks, before flowering suddenly into these long, floppy hands of mine. When I arrived back at the house, everything seemed to have returned to normal, and it occurred to me that the problem might be with my body rather than my clothes. Of course, I wouldn't think of speaking to Mrs. Wilkinson about any of this. She has already made her views clear on the subject. She has forbidden me to wear more than one of any article of clothing at any one time, no more than one pair of trousers, one shirt, one jersey, and so on, though naturally I defy her on this, as I like to wear as many of my clothes as I can. I find it reassuring, and since returning from Canada, reassurance is something I'm simply not getting enough of. Probably the whole thing was just some sort of perceptual error. I have occasionally been troubled this way in the past. I'm a much taller man than my father was, but in other respects I resemble him. He was wiry and short-sighted. He wore round, horn-rimmed spectacles that made him appear owlish. His eyes had a deceptively mild, watery sort of look to them, and when he took his spectacles off, you realised what a startlingly pale blue colour they were. But I've seen those eyes of his fire up with anger, and when that happened, there was nothing mild and watery about him at all, and as often as not, I'd be taken down the coal cellar and feel the back of his belt. Not that he'd let anyone else ever see his anger. He was much too careful for that. But my mother and myself, we saw it. He had no other outlet for it. We were the only people in the world weaker than he was. I remember my mother used to say, "Run down the dog, Spider, and tell your father his supper's on the table." And that's when I knew I'd see that furious pale light come up. The dog was the pub on the corner of Kitchener Street, the Dog and Beggar. It was not a big pub. There were four rooms, the public bar, the saloon bar, and two small snugs where private conversation could be had, each room separated from the others by a wooden screen inset with panels of frosted glass. My father drank in the public bar, and I can still recall pushing open the door and being immediately assailed by a welter of sounds and smells, men's talk, their barks of laughter, thick smoke, beer, sawdust on the bare boards, and in the winter, a small coal fire burning in the grate. Above the mantelpiece, I remember, was a mirror with a black toucan on it, and the words, "Guinness is good for you." I couldn't read the first word. I only knew that something was good for you. There wasn't anything good for me in the public bar of the Dog and Beggar. I'd see him at the bar, his back bent, leaning with his elbows on the counter and one boot up on the brass rail that ran the length of it at ankle height. Someone would say, "Here's Horace's boy," or "Here's your boy, Horace." And I'd see him turn toward me, a cigarette hanging from his lip. And in his eyes there'd be only that cold loathing that came of being reminded again of the fact of his family and the house to which he must return from the careless sanctuary of the public bar. I'd blurt out my message, my little voice piping like a tin whistle among those shuffling, grunting men, those cattle at their beer, and he would tell me to go on back to the house. He'd be along shortly. No one would know, only I. How intense, how venomous was the hatred he felt toward me at that moment, and I'd hurry away as quick as I could. I was never able to tell my mother how much I disliked going into the Dog and delivering her message, for my father disguised his feelings so effectively, she would have laughed to hear me explain what was really going on. When he was in this frame of mind, and drinking only made things worse, drinking broke down his reserve, mealtimes were hell. I would sit at the kitchen table, gazing at the ceiling, where an unshaded bulb dangled on the end of a braided brown cord. I tended always to slip into reverie in that poky little kitchen, with its clanging pots and dripping tap and ever-present smell of boiling cabbage. It made those ghastly meals tolerable. Outside, the twilight darkened into night, and from over by the railway embankment came the scream of a whistle as some suburban train went steaming by. My mother put in front of me a plate of boiled potatoes, boiled cabbage, and stewed neck of mutton, the meat coming away from the bone in stringy greyish patches. There was a terrible tension in the room as I picked up my knife and fork. I knew my father was watching me. And this made things worse, for I was a clumsy boy at the best of times, only poorly in control of those long, gangling limbs of mine. I stuffed a large lump of potato in my mouth, but it was too hot, so I had to cough it back onto my plate. "For Christ's sake," he hissed between clenched teeth. My mother glanced at him, her own fork poised over a potato that sat like a plug in a greasy puddle of thin gravy. "Don't lose your temper," she murmured. "It's not the boy's fault." The meal progressed in painful silence. There were no further train noises from over by the railway embankment, nor was there anything moving on Kitchener Street. Cutlery clattered on cheap china as we ate our neck of mutton, and the tap dripped into the sink with a steady plop, plop, plop. The bulb overhead continued to spread a sickly yellow light over the room, and having devoured my food, I sat once more gazing at the ceiling with my lips faintly moving, pausing only to pick at a shred of mutton caught between my teeth. "Put the kettle on then, Spider," said my mother, and I rose to my feet. As I did so, I banged one of my kneecaps against the side of the table, jarring it violently, such that my father's plate moved several inches to the left. I felt him stiffen then. I felt his grip tighten on his fork, onto the end of which he had just scraped a soggy pile of pale, limp cabbage. But mercifully, he said nothing. I lit the gas. At last he finished eating, laid his knife and fork across the middle of his plate, placed his hands on the edge of the table, elbows arched outward at a sharp angle, and prepared to get up from the table. "Off down the pub, I suppose," said my mother, still at work on her last potato, which she had cut into a number of very small pieces, and without lifting her eyes to my father's face. I cast a quick, fearful glance at him, and in the way his jaw worked, I knew what he thought of the pair of us, his gangling, useless son and his mutely reproachful wife, who sat there making little pokes and stabs at her potato and refusing to meet his eye. He took his cap and jacket from the hook on the back of the door and went out without a word. The kettle came to the boil. "Make us a nice cup of tea then, Spider," said my mother, rising from her chair and brushing at her cheek as she began to gather the dirty plates.
Patrick McGraw, reading from his new novel, Spider, just published by Poseidon Press. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're going to be taking a look at our strategy in the Gulf, considering how the United States forces are arrayed there and what it looks like we think we might have to do there. We have a big piece tonight from Poland talking about moving into the world of capitalism. A man who makes rubber gloves in Poland will show us what he thinks he's up against and what he thinks he can do. And we've had an interesting political day. Outsiders are winning in Massachusetts, and a limit on terms wins in Oklahoma.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If it's true, as Napoleon once observed, that an army marches on its stomach, it may be equally true that a culture feeds, both spiritually and physically, on its cuisine. Commentator John Jefferson, who lives in Tennessee, says in the Deep South, deep fried prevails.
Mention oil imports here in the South, and you're likely to conjure up visions of Mazzola being trucked in from the Midwest. This is the region culinarily synonymous with fatback, fried green tomatoes, and my coronary artery's personal favorite, sawmill gravy. That's a wallpaper paste-looking concoction whipped up from sausage grease, flour, and milk. This is the place that made Colonel Sanders not just a rich man, but a holy man, the high priest of the batter dipped and deep fried. Of course, the national obsession with youth and immortality being what it is, lean cuisine has established a beachhead even here in Dixie. But the battle for the hearts and minds and waistlines of America is far from over, and diehard Southern cooks are not above guerrilla tactics. I was in a trendy restaurant in Atlanta, the capital of the new old South, but it might as well have been L.A. The menu featured fish and poultry, pasta and veggies. The word fried was conspicuously absent. baked and broiled, sautéed and steamed. Those were the verbs du jour. But there was something comfortingly familiar about the rolls, a light, delicate crunch to the crust, not the brusque, brittle shell of French bread or the unruly chewiness of sourdough. They were almost like doughnuts without the glaze. So I asked the waiter. He gave me a knowing wink and said yes, they were deep-fried. We Southerners will have our minimum daily requirement of grease. It is the fifth basic food group, after all. This Dixie death grip on grease is about more than just cholesterol or calories or even taste. It really is about culture, the South's last stand against change, a way to hang on to a comforting piece of the past as more and more of our traditions and institutions are lost or lampooned or simply overshadowed by world hunger and the threat of war. But somehow when you're sitting around a dinner table with family and friends and the foods you grew up on and your parents and their parents grew up on, the problems of this September or even this century seem to slip away for a while. This fondness for frying is also about language, the verbal cornstarch that glues a culture together. It's really grease, not linguistics, that explains the much maligned Southern drawl. It's kind of hard to make a glottal stop when your glottis and your epiglottis are thoroughly lubricated. And it's nigh on to impossible to keep you all from gliding out as y'all. You can turn our cotton fields into shopping malls. You can convert our old-time religion to new-age mysticism. You can even reduce the Grand Ole Opry to a hokey hillbilly theme park. But you can't make us say, you skies. And you can't take our frying pans away. Long as everybody understands that, we can be real neighborly. So come see us. And be sure you stay for dinner.
John Jefferson lives in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and readings. Our production assistants are Rossanne Bucci and Sue Spolin. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jack Kerouac based the hero of his novel Dharma Bums on poet Gary Snyder. On the next Fresh Air, Gary Snyder on poetry, Buddhism, and the wilderness. Also, the cartooning team of Drew and Josh Allen Friedman talk about their bizarre gallery of washed-up actors, nightmare teachers, and grown men who sell comic books. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.